From my mom's house in Southern California, this is The Organist, an arts and culture podcast from McSweeney's and KCRW. I'm Andrew Leland. These days, most of us are a lot more worried than we used to be about fact distortion. There's even a new name for the problem, fake news or alternative facts. It's like, oh, did I say wiretapping? Obviously, I meant wiretapping. And with so many bad, truth-obscuring fictions out there, it's important to remember what good fiction might do for us. Consider the author Lynn Tillman. Tillman has, for decades, made up stories that can actually enhance our thinking about what's real. Her latest collection, The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories, merges art criticism and fiction. And that doesn't mean she just collected her art criticism and her fiction and put them side by side in a book. Instead, Tillman created a fictional character named Madame Realism, who, in the guise of fiction, visits and critiques real-world exhibits at places like the Met in New York. These stories have charted new ways to think about how art channels our ideas about the real world. And at a moment when so much of our political and social landscape is defined by bad fictions, we need work like Tillman's. Work that helps us become more thoughtful about all the figments that mix together to make our reality. But Tillman's fiction isn't didactic. It moves from idea to idea associatively. Tillman says that this character, Madame Realism, is, at her core, all about following her thinking wherever it may lead her.
I don't think of her so much as rambling as associating to objects. And when I wrote the second one I did, that was for an art magazine, for Art in America. And because I wasn't an art historian or art critic, just somebody who was looking at things and thinking about them, and I'd actually studied painting, studio painting, I wanted to bring my ignorance along with me when I went to visit this museum showing a great number of paintings by Renoir. And so I also brought a tape recorder, and I tape recorded pretending that I was using one of those docent machines. I tape recorded people standing in front of Renoir's paintings and used them in the piece. And of course, they were all different kinds of people, and they said all different kinds of things.
So for The Organist, the writer Adam Coleman performed a similar experiment. He went with Lynn to the Museum of Modern Art in New York with a tape recorder to see what kind of conversations happen around a painting. Here's Adam.
When you go to a museum, what do you notice? You look at the art, the dinosaur bones, the dioramas, but surely you also regard the other visitors, the security guards, the docents. You hear their conversations. You notice them staring. Lynn Tillman's character, Madame Realism, also thinks about the world that surrounds art. The way, say, the crowd around a painting can change your experience of the work, just as the painting can, in the best case, change you. One of the stories in the new book is called Madame Realism Asks What's Natural About Painting. In it, Madame Realism's experience of art is transformed by the experience of seeing it with other people.
Wanting very much to leave and eat, to go home, tired of the insistent flow in front of paintings of which she was very much a part, Madame Realism was entrapped by another conversation, carried on by two men and a woman. The first man to speak was waving his arms rather excitedly, saying the washerwomen were square. He was painting things as if they were rigid, fixed in a space that wouldn't move. The woman responded, "You can see why his paintings would appeal to the common man and woman. His people are just so unself-conscious." The first man countered, "But his talent was remarkable." The second man asked, "In his notes and letters, is there a more cerebral quality?" The first man answered, "No, and he wasn't a happy person." The woman exclaimed, "But his paintings have such joy." Both men said vitality in unison. "It's often true," said the first man. "He was a very cranky guy from a poor family. The sensuality in all his paintings, just wishful thinking." The woman said, "He was like Mozart, a basic talent, but without intellect." The first man threw his arms out again and implored, "But he was a natural flowing talent. It just flowed out." The second man said, "Genius."
Lynn Tillman herself takes an adventurous, exploratory approach to museums, and so I was excited to meet her at the MoMA's Picabia exhibit, titled Our Heads Are Round So Our Thoughts Can Change Direction. The show covered the absolutely crazy career of a 20th century artist whose work included Impressionism, Cubism, Dadaism, and Surrealism. Picabia made shimmering metallic paintings of mechanical objects that have no evident use. He made lush imitations of Impressionist paintings. A small room off to the side projected a film Picabia made in 1924. He was all over the map.
All over the map. I sort of identify with that. I think the artists and writers who probably become most read, at least in their time, are more consistent.
Yeah.
Most looked at. Something. Which direction are we going to go? Our heads are round, so we can go in any direction.
Picabia was part of a group of artists in Paris, including Pablo Picasso and Gertrude Stein. This sparked a memory for Lynn about her time in Paris.
It's funny, when I decided I wanted to be an American abroad was when, you know, I read about all these Americans who were there, and I sort of expected that when I got to Paris, it would be just the most amazing place in the world. And what I saw was so conservative. I remember arriving, walking around, and there weren't people hanging from ceilings or whatever. It's just like, it was more straight than New York, really.
Lynn Tillman is free associating here. It's something that Madame Realism does all the time in her book.
If I'm writing in response to a particular work, or I look at what that work is, and I begin to think about what it makes me think about. I'm basically watching my thinking and observing that going on, and then that raises questions. So that's the way it starts.
Seeing something would remind Lynn of something else, which would bring to mind still other things. Associations led to reflections on her past, but also on the world surrounding art, the world of museums and art history and politics.
It would be impossible to separate context from any kind of experience, I think. And that's why institutional critique in art in the 70s and 80s became so dominant. How do we look at art? And how does a museum present that work to us? How much is written on those placards? How much should be there? Does the curator direct the viewer's understanding of art or not? Political context, all of these contexts affect what we write, what we make. And it's not often direct. It can be quite indirect.
When you're walking through an art gallery, there's a lot of stuff to think about beyond what's hanging on the walls. There's your own imaginative response to the art. There's the museum's creative structuring of an exhibit, the way curators choose to tell the story of an artist. There are the myths and popular fictions of the artist's own social world. This raises the question, how can we look at a painting without these distractions crowding out our view? How do we make our way through so many tangled ideas? For Lynn Tillman, the answer is in the process of writing fiction.
I mean, I use fiction in a way to explore ideas, and not necessarily ones that I hold. I have a character to do that. And I'm interested in consciousness, which includes what you take in during the day, any kind of social reality, and also your imaginative response to it. And when I was first asked to write something for Art in America, I told Craig Owens, the senior editor, I'm not an art critic. He said, well, we know that. We're asking you, we know you're a fiction writer. So then I took advantage of that.
In fiction, Lynn has found a method for thinking about social complexities as well as art. She invented Madame Realism in order to rethink a major part of art history.
It was way back in 1983. I received a phone call from somebody I forget his name, and he asked me if I wanted to contribute to a magazine of surrealism. I thought this was absurd. And I said, no, thank you. I hung up, and I began thinking about Merritt Oppenheim, who was a surrealist, and she was still alive, and I had met her, and she was in Paris, and she was one of the few female surrealists who got attention. And I began thinking about the position of women in surrealism. And then Madame Realism became a retort to surrealism. And then I wrote a story, just because I wanted to write this story, the first Madame Realism story, and I asked Kiki Smith, who had not yet become Kiki Smith, the very well-known, terrific artist, if she wanted to do drawings for it. And we got a grant to do a chapbook, which we did. And that was the first Madame Realism. A lot of what is intellectually a problem for me is that things have gotten so separated that the function of the novel as seen as entertainment, which divorces it from the idea that it's has ideas, is a sadness to me, because it's not that reading Mill on the Floor isn't entertaining to me, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have ideas in it. I think not being reactive to events, but being able to contemplate, not to have an opinion about everything, not to have certainty, is what fiction can offer. And now I believe good fiction, and we can argue what that would be, can be true. That's one of its benefits, is that it can be true to life, but it's not actually necessarily based in events. I think, and often fiction writers say something like, it's a true story, and it drives me crazy, you know, or it's based on true events. That's the TV version. And there's such a difference between saying this is an actual event and that fiction isn't true because it's not an actual event. It just drives me mad. I think the debasing of fiction has gone on for a very long time in America, and maybe other places too, and certainly I think since the 70s. You have to kind of accept the discomfort of living without certainty.
This kind of acceptance of uncertainty seems necessary for Lynn Tillman's fiction, which is calm, collected, and supremely thoughtful. So I asked her about coolness in her work.
I think what I was saying before about not, I don't know if I said it, but I was thinking about not being reactive politically or in any way. And I think coolness in that sense, in writing, in my writing, when it exists, has to do with allowing for some distance and not being reactive. And trying to look at something coolly doesn't mean coldly, but it means without immediately making assumptions or jumping all over it, just holding back a little bit. And that also, in the way that you can't separate style from content, that is part of what makes the style I use in writing, and sometimes it changes for different things. But with the Madame Realism stories and with the translation artist, it is about what is the role of an observer in one's own life also. Not you participate, but you're always also looking at what you're doing and what you're looking at looking too. And it's not noncommittal. And it's not coolness as noncommittal, right, but it's as a kind of intellectual and aesthetic approach to looking.
In the most overloaded room of the exhibit, we heard a composition written by Peccabia, first performed in Paris in 1920, called The American Nurse. Okay, I'm going to pick up some of the music. It's music that literally gives you pause. When I listen to this piece now, in a moment of cool reflection, I hear in its pauses the burbling sounds of everyone else in the room.
It's three notes repeated monotonously, they put it on the piano.
Those generous pauses draw your attention to all the other sounds in the exhibit. With this music, Peccabia has produced something similar to Madame Realism's musings in the Renoir exhibit. The sonic world around the art, the confused murmuring of the visitors, their footsteps, floods into your perception.
After the break, as Lynn Tillman contemplates the social context of modernist painting, a skeptical security guard kicks her and Adam out of the museum. We'll be right back. And now, back to Lynn Tillman, wandering around the Museum of Modern Art.
When you're seeing something and you're in a group of people, it's really hard. At least it's very hard for me not to be aware of people speaking. And maybe this is, as a writer, you grow up if you're observing things. Not just looking, but listening at the same time, because language is going to shape, in some ways, the way you experience what you're seeing. It often does. The sound of people walking around might throw me, or a sigh or a sob, you know, to be a little hyperbolic. There was, in the beginning of the 20th century, such an effort, and it continued into the mid-century, to fuse the arts. And obviously the Surrealists and the Cubists with Stein and Picasso and Braque, and the Manifestos and André Breton, and the Futurists and their Manifesto. The idea that the arts could be combined. I mean, look at this. I was just looking. It's called Music is Like Painting. And I think this would appeal to quite a number of contemporary artists I know, including Steve Prina, who has done paintings, anyway, drawings that work off the idea of a painting or an artwork being a score.
But even the coolest, most thoughtfully associative experience of art has its limits. At one point, a guard saw my microphone. He approached me and Lynn. He made it clear that I would be contributing to this carefully curated place in an unwanted way.
We've been given permission for this. Yeah, we're recording an interview. We've coordinated this with Moma. They told us.
Permission through the education department.
Earlier, testing out my microphone in the lobby of the museum, I marveled at the fact that I could have a large microphone in public and no one would care. But people care. Think about Madame Realism in the Renoir exhibit. People notice other people in a gallery. Nobody's just looking at paintings isolated from everything else. A work's environment in some way shapes that work. And so we had to leave.
Do you want me to wait up here? Or where do you have to go?
Education department. We can find out from here.
Eventually, a guard told us that we had to leave the museum and walk around to a different entrance. It wasn't clear why.
The thing is, where else would we see this art? It is a big problem. When you go into private homes, and by now I've gone into many that have incredible collections, you realize that unless you are invited to that home, You will never see that work. And so the museum is the place where you can see it. Now, these mega situations, the explosion of that, I guess, starting in the 80s, makes the viewing experience very different. So you try to get around it by going at odd times, and I don't know. The experience of everything is way more, when you watch television, you're watching probably with millions of people. When you read a book, you're reading alone. That's always a very private experience. I'm not as, when I can't get into something.
Okay. Maybe we'll, we got thwarted by the revolving door. Okay, we'll do this one at a time.
Okay.
Yeah. Back inside, nobody seemed to know how we could regain permission to enter the galleries.
I don't know where they want you to go. They said to go to a desk. Where?
They said to go to a reception desk.
I think, can you phone them?
By the time we finally made it back into the exhibit, I was more aware than ever about the museum around us. I was seeing the museum in the style of Madame Realism.
I don't know yet, but boy, is that a beautiful frame. Lovely work of silver.
Tillman's responses at the museum remind me of her fiction. On the page and at the museum, she freely advances from an observation about a work of art to an observation about the world around that work, allowing thoughts to grow, at choice, at will, in an uninhibited way.
It's all about choice, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean all the world is about choice, obviously. Our choices are quite limited. But when you're making something, which is one of the reasons I like writing, I have about as much choice as I have anywhere in life. And that's why you try to expand your choices. That's why I don't write every story in the same style.
Really, there were three creators in conversation with one another at the museum on that day. The 20th century Dadaist / Cubist / everything else Francis Picabia, the museum, and the critical viewer Lynn Tillman. All three contributed to what you've been hearing. Lynn Tillman is an expert at building from perceptions associatively and constructing some new understanding through those associations. For example, in Lynn's book, Madame Realism thinks about Coney Island's weird Epcot-like dreamland, which reminds her of Freud's writing on dreams, which leads to Freud's personal collection of religious art. By the end of these wanderings, the reader has somehow found new possibilities for understanding the unconscious, commercial entertainment, and art. Madame Realism helps us find new ways for thinking about a world full of art and ideas, both high and low. Reading these stories, you get a better sense of how works of the imagination, much like Picabia's music in the MoMA gallery, can both alter the world around them and help refine our attention to all the details of that world.
The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories by Lynn Tillman is out now from Semiotext. That piece was written and produced by Adam Coleman with Jenny Amint. Adam is a writer based in Western Massachusetts, and his book about the intersections between fiction and nonfiction is forthcoming from Fiction Advocate. The Organist is produced by Ross Simonini and me, a sculpture of an ancient woman about to eat a handful of berries. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weisskopf. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White. We're mixed and engineered at KCRW by Mario Diaz and Kat Ewer. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Will Howard. I've never met any of these people in person. If you like The Organist, leave us a rating and a review in the iTunes store. One person who recently did this and seemed enriched by the experience is Maura Cassidy. Maura is a woman who lives in Denver, where she copy edits PowerPoint presentations about the Chilean battery market for a living. She's also working on a novel, and so here, my friends, is Maura Cassidy's iTunes review for The Organist. Enjoy.
There was a period of time, I'm embarrassed to say exactly how long, when a U2 song played automatically every time I turned on my car. At first, because I keep the volume of my car radio turned low, I didn't even know it was a song at all. I experienced it only as a vague kind of maddening hum, a subdural melody swelling and expanding in the membranous space around my skull. Which is, I think, why I didn't want to turn it up. For a while, I just rolled the windows down. It was fall. It didn't occur to me for weeks that it was even coming from the radio, because why would the radio always be playing the same thing every time you get into your car? The weather eventually got colder, and I was forced to roll up the windows. I learned the truth on my way to lunch, mid-November. I turned up the radio to hear Chris Kimball, the smug one from America's Test Kitchen, talking about how to make the most of cooking for one. He was starting to explain to Terry Gross why she should stop microwaving chicken breasts, that there were equally convenient and more delicious ways to prepare a single chicken breast. But the music performed some kind of manual override of the radio, closing my window into Terry's personal life. The song is called The Miracle, parenthesis, of Joey Ramone, from the album Songs of Innocence. The corresponding album art blossomed into light across my center console. I thought about William Blake and child labor in industrial Britain. I thought about Bert and Mary Poppins and the scene where she talks to her own reflection. It's a game, isn't it, Mary Poppins, etc. I started to put the pieces together. The image on the screen was a vaguely homoerotic black and white photo, two shirtless men, one on his knees embracing the other one around the waist, a kind of modest Robert Mapplethorpe. The song itself, at full volume, has a dull, heavily focused grouped mirth to it. Harmonized chanting draws the listener in, wordless and neat, to a world of artfully buried overdrive guitar and indeterminate computer noise. The song operates on the logically baffling premise that a blown-out stadium rock stomper, you can even hear the boot sound, presumably Bono's, could be whittled into an inoffensive adult contemporary B-side in post-production. Bono's vocals come in inevitably and drown the track in a nonsensical first-person account I assume eventually resolves the question of the Joey Ramone reference in the title. I usually tapped out around 15 seconds in, or as soon as I could remember that the U2 song was coming from my radio and make it stop. When I asked the obvious questions, why this song, why me, my imagination ran wild. Wasn't this background music for a Hyundai commercial I'd seen? Was the coincidence that I was hearing only the first 15 seconds of that Hyundai commercial? And if I waited 15 more seconds, they would tell me about the 12-month 0% APR? Do young people want to pack their economy sedans to the gills and road trip to adventurous places, rolling choruses thumping politely in the background? I don't know. I'm 62. I drive a Prius. Of course, Blake's Songs of Innocence is devastating in a way that Songs of Experience never could be. Joey Ramone was beaten almost to death in Queens on his way to the Ramones' first performance. It says on his Wikipedia page that the last song Joey listened to while dying of lymphoma in 2001 was by U2. Robert Mapplethorpe died in the 80s due to complications from HIV/AIDS. Bono paid $1,500 to fly his own hat first class from London to Milan in time for his performance with Liza Minnelli. I typed my questions into the Apple user forum once in the subject line and then once again in the body of the forum. I would like to delete the preloaded U2 music from my iTunes file. Can anyone help me? I would like to delete the preloaded U2 music from my iPhone. Can anyone help me with this? Thanks, George. Eventually, I got a response. I loaded into iTunes for the first time. I marveled briefly at the glittering panoply of options. I entered the secret administrative panel of the program and pasted my key, http://iTunes.com/SOI-remove. I was free. But silence, emptiness, and the nagging whistle of the wind penetrating the spongy rubber sealer on my window was all that filled my short, dark days. I thought seriously about re-uploading the U2 album. I thought about Innocence. A colleague had recently recommended I try the Organist podcast. He described it as weird, wacky, yet entertaining and informative. It was easy for me to download and place onto my phone through iTunes. I've learned that my Prius automatically connects to my phone through Bluetooth and begins to play whatever is in my iTunes library, and that I can turn off the Bluetooth if I don't want that to happen. All in all, I've really come around to the convenience of the feature, the way it makes the organist spring to life from my car's stereo speakers, and how the organist podcast makes familiar subjects seem surprising and unfamiliar subjects seem urgently relevant. I like to keep the windows up and to steep in the soundscape. This podcast has saved me from my Prius. In the wake of the U2 incident, the organist is the ice axe that has broken the frozen sea inside me.
You can read the rest of Mora's iTunes review on our iTunes page, where you should also, might also, you can also leave your own. You can also find Mora's writing on our email newsletter, which is at kcrw.com/theorganist. And special thanks this week to Garrett Stewart for bringing Mora's review to life. We'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.